11. The Haifa Pipeline. On February 11, 2003, Douglas Feith, the Bush administration's Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, appeared before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where he argued that the Iraq War, if it arrived, would not be a war for oil. "All of Iraq's oil belongs to all the people of Iraq," Feith said. The Bush administration had not yet decided on the organizational mechanisms through which the Iraqi oil industry might be restructured after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, but he felt that he should address head-on the accusation that, in this confrontation with the Iraqi regime, the administration's motive is to steal or control Iraq's oil. That charge was commonly made, but it was false and malign. By the time of his Senate testimony, Feith had already become a punching bag for opponents of the Bush administration and its foreign policies. He was a tall, extroverted man with a mop of graying hair and round, wire-rimmed glasses. His articulate self-confidence was of the type associated with student council vice presidents, and it grated on some people similarly. General Tommy Franks, then in command of all U.S. military forces in the Middle East, told colleagues at the time that he considered Feith the fucking stupidest guy on the face of the earth. Franks's Pentagon colleagues debated his own acumen. A lawyer in private practice before joining the Pentagon at the request of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, Feith proved willing, at the least, to argue like a litigator about the rationales for a U.S. invasion of Iraq. He told the senators that the United States had no historical record of stealing other countries' resources through war. "We did not pillage Germany or Japan. On the contrary, we helped rebuild them after World War II," he said. After Desert Storm, the U.S.-led campaign to liberate Kuwait from Iraq, which prevailed in 1991, "We did not use our military power to take or establish control over the oil resource of Iraq or any other country in the Gulf region." The idea that the Bush administration would take on the human and financial costs of overthrowing Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq for the sake of grabbing that country's oil did not make logical sense, Feith continued. "If our motive were cold cash, we would instead downplay the Iraqi regime's weapons of mass destruction and pander to Saddam in hopes of winning contracts for U.S. companies," he said. "The major costs of any confrontation with the Iraqi regime would, of course, be the human ones, but the financial costs would not be small either. This confrontation is not, and cannot possibly be, a moneymaker for the United States. Only someone ignorant of the easy-to-ascertain realities could think that the United States could profit from such a war, even if we were willing to steal Iraq's oil, which we emphatically are not going to do." In the weeks to come, Bush administration cabinet officers and independent analysts would endorse Feith's position that the war had, as Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld put it, literally nothing to do with oil. The administration published its war aims. These made no mention of energy or economic issues. The invasion's stated goals were to eliminate Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, end the threat Saddam posed to neighboring governments, stop his regime's internal tyranny, cut off his links to terrorism, maintain Iraq's territorial integrity, liberate Iraq's people, and create a democracy. It was true that Saddam's capacity to threaten the world was in part a result of the cash he received from oil sales. In that limited but important sense, the administration's war aims could be said to be about oil. It could also be argued that the United States would not have incurred all the risks and costs of invading Iraq if the country did not have large oil reserves, and therefore an innately important place in the global economy and regional power balances. But that was different from arguing that the United States intended to launch a war for the purpose of acquiring Iraq's reserves. What would it mean, in any event, for the United States to steal Iraq's oil? The question itself illuminated America's dysfunctional search for a national understanding of energy security. The United States formerly owned oil only to operate government vehicles and aircraft and to fill a 700 million barrel strategic petroleum reserve. The government amply met these needs by purchasing oil on the open market. The American economy required about 12 million barrels of imported oil every day in 2003, But these supplies were purchased from private and government-owned oil producers around the world. Invading Iraq wouldn't change that market much, except perhaps unfavorably, from an American perspective, by raising prices through the disruptions caused by war. It was possible to imagine that President Bush might wage war as a conscious or unconscious proxy for the interests of American-headquartered oil companies, notwithstanding the fact that most of these companies were global in scale, employed more foreigners than Americans, and paid more taxes to overseas governments than to the United States Treasury. Yet even if the Bush administration were thoroughly infused by such corporate-inspired perfidy, invading Iraq did not seem like an especially cost-effective way to help ExxonMobil, Chevron, or Conoco expand their booked oil reserves. In an essay published on the Iraq War's eve, the oil analyst Daniel Yergin argued that even a liberated Iraq might be reluctant to allow much direct participation in its oil sector by American firms because of the prevalence of resource nationalism among Arab populations. He cited the example of Kuwait. After the 1991 Gulf War, a liberated and grateful Kuwait announced that it would open its oil industry to foreign investment in order to boost production. 11 years later, that still hasn't happened, owing to nationalistic opposition. Perhaps, then, the invasion of Iraq would be a war for oil in a geopolitical sense, for the purpose of increasing Iraqi oil production from the moribund levels of the Saddam Hussein era, and by doing so, reducing world oil prices and America's dependence on Saudi Arabia. In the run-up to the invasion, a few conservative thinkers floated versions of this rationale, inflamed in part by evidence of Saudi Arabia's support for Islamic radicals such as those responsible for the September 11 attacks. But although Iraq had large untapped reserves of 115 billion barrels or more, its daily production amounted to only 2 or 3% of the world's total. After the U.S.-led invasion, even if all went well, it would take a decade or more to double Iraqi production to 6 million barrels per day. And even then, Iraq could not hope to challenge Saudi Arabia's dominance as the world's most influential swing producer and price-setter in oil markets, able to raise or lower output as market conditions demanded. Saudi production capacity would still likely be twice that of Iraq's.